And good afternoon. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Our weekly mission, say it with me, to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week, we welcome back to the panel our friend Steve Rothaus, who is a writer for the Miami Herald for a very long time and authors the Gay South Florida column and covers many other issues related to the gay, lesbian, LGBT community in South Florida. Steve, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Phil.
Also with us, another return engagement for Paula Uspa Abbott, who is with the Daily Business Review, writing the stories of sea level change and basic economy, real estate, and all the things that are happening here in South Florida. And we welcome her back to these microphones as well. Good to see you.
Happy to be back.
We go up to Tallahassee because a lot of the news this week has come from Tallahassee. Been kind of a slow week in South Florida as far as news is concerned, but plenty going on in the Capitol in the final days of session. Derek Hamm is a reporter with the Palm Beach Post covering politics based in the Capitol. Dara, we welcome you back.
Hey, guys. How are you?
And you are welcome to join the conversation. We have phone lines at 800-743-WLRN. We are also very engaged on the social media front. We have a Facebook page, and we also have an online discussion that is being curated by our social media editor, Danny Rivero, at our website, WLRN.org. And you can also follow us at @WLRN. Let's begin with the discussion of the economy, because we did get some pretty good news, at least on the surface, for what we heard this week, Paula Uspa Abbott, about real estate prices. And we found out that prices have gone up in Miami-Dade County, Broward, and Palm Beach counties by 25% or more. That would seem to be pretty good news.
Well, it depends on how you say it. It's very good news for people who probably their properties are underwater or, you know, own properties who want values to go up. But at the same time, if you look under the surface, this may be indication of a new bubble on the horizon. And I tell you why. For example, in Dade County, and I know we're going to be talking about it, we have almost 10% of unemployment, right? Mm-hmm. So many of us obviously are not buying homes. Many of us are not having salaries increases, and some actually federal employees are seeing their salary cut. So we're not buying homes. So who are buying homes? These are investors and up to a certain level speculators. We do have investors from South America who probably need to have or want to have a second home here. But then we have equity funds like, you know, Blackstone Colony Capital, that what they're doing is they're buying up to 30 to 40 properties, single family homes a month, so they can create a rental portfolio. So they're going to buy, REOs or, you know, properties owned by banks, foreclosed properties. And their goal is to, you know, own them for like 7 years, 10 years, and then sell them. So why am I saying that probably there is another bubble? Because we're seeing a huge number of rental properties now that are going to be hitting the market. At the same time, we have way too many apartment operators building apartment communities. Some are in the planning stages. Some are buying land to develop them in the near future. So we're going to get to a point where we're going to have such a huge rental inventory that many of those units are going to go vacant for months. Many of these homes being bought by speculators are going to go empty. So what are they going to do? They're going to dump this property. You know how equity funds work. They're going to dump them at, you know, they're going to try to cut their losses. So they're going to sell them at whatever price they have to. And that's...
prices will go down at some point.
Right.
Or, but this is the history, Steve Rothaus of Florida, is real estate booms and busts. So you can always expect one coming.
So, and Paula, is this a good time to sell your home or to sell your property? How is the supply right now?
It is a good time to sell. The supply is very low. According to some experts, we have like 5 months supply of property. So it is a good time. You know, some people say if you wait another year and this bubble doesn't pop, you can sell it for more money, right? Because appreciation, you know, some homes are selling for 25% more than a year ago. So it is a good time. You know, it could be a better time a year from now, and it could be a really bad time 2 years from now when this bubble pops.
So if the bubble bursts, then you would have trouble selling your property.
I assume you're going to have trouble selling because there's going to be so much on the market. And obviously, what you're going to get for a property at that time is going to be probably less than you could get for it today.
Hey, Derek Cam, I'm just curious, listening in from Tallahassee, where the real estate's a different deal, but how are the markets there, the real estate market in your part of the world?
The markets in Tallahassee have stayed pretty consistent. We haven't been impacted by that bubble. So I don't think that we will really have, we don't have the kinds of foreclosures that you guys have seen, and we haven't had the, we didn't have that boom in the property values. I don't think that we would be impacted, but, sort of taking it into the impact on the legislature here, that recovery is part of why lawmakers have extra money to spend, and we'll talk about that later on, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that, the increase in the collection and property taxes is one of the reasons why lawmakers for the first time don't have a deficit for the first time in 6 years.
Right, and the job situation, despite the fact that there are some abnormal numbers in Miami-Dade County, at least right now, as Paula mentioned before, Miami-Dade unemployment's almost at double digits. Broward is below 6%. So two largest counties in the state, there's like a 4% difference in the unemployment rate. That's a big disparity, isn't it, Paula?
Some economists say that Miami-Dade County has a lot of newcomers from other countries who it's harder for them to find jobs because their language may be limited. And, of course, you have people who speak perfect English unemployed who are ahead of the line. But those people eventually are going to go to school, they're going to get a certificate or a degree or some, and they're going to join the workforce. So, maybe it's not, we're not comparing apples to oranges when we look at Miami-Dade County, because like I said, we have this influx mm-hmm. of people from other countries who, are not working at this moment.
And by the way, what's the winter tourism season looking like now that we've sort of wrapped up? Anything on that, or and any other signs that the economy is improving here in South Florida and in the state for that matter?
Oof, that's a great question. Yes, there are a lot of positive signs for sure. I do talk to people who are hiring, but I'm sure we're going to be talking about it. The hiring is targeted to people with certain skills. Mm. So companies are growing.
What skills are those?
Technology, a lot of math. Like banks are looking people like crazy, people who can think analytically, and they're good with math.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, anything that is software-related, computer-related.
Mm-hmm. That's Paula Huspa-Abbott. She's with the Daily Business Review. Also with us is Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald, Derek Hamm from the Palm Beach Post. And, we'll continue sort of the business and economy discussion here for a moment. But it seems like, and the governor even came out this week, Dara in Tallahassee, and Steve here in Miami talked about how the airports are being affected. And I think everybody that's been through an airport or has talked to people who have gone through airports are now complaining about the effects of the budget cuts and how they've had an effect on customs and everything else. Paula, you want to talk about
sure.
it?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to monopolize the
show. No, please.
You tell me when to shut up.
You can be quiet later.
Okay, good. Deal. Well, I have a good friend of mine who works for American Airlines behind the counter. And she's telling me that people who are coming to Miami, they flew for 9 hours because they are either coming from South America or Europe. They arrived in the morning, tired, cranky, and they have to wait up to 4 hours sometimes in the immigration and custom line. And she's telling me many people are missing their flights. And, of course, she said, my employer, American Airlines, have to put them in another flight at our own expense because it's not their fault. She said that people are getting pretty upset about, all the waiting. They're being treated like they're not important. And many of them are helping fuel our economy, right? Their capital, the money that they spend here.
Yeah, and Dara, we heard the governor complaining loudly this week and squarely blaming President Obama for the sequestration issue. So he sort of dived into the politics of all this.
That's true. I was just looking through my email. The governor had was part of this. I don't know if he started it, but it was part of this Twitter thing about hashtag free the FAA. So he was pretty angry about the flight delays and its impact on Florida tourism because of the sequestration. that had an impact on the number of air traffic controllers. So that was what he was saying, you know, he was blaming the president and Congress for that, you know, that they're concerned about, because the governor has been making much of Florida's recovery. Mm. Our unemployment level has dropped, whatever.
It's dipped in drips, I think.
I'm sorry. It is a busy day in Tallahassee, I can tell you that, so I'm a little kerfuffled. But so he's been making a big deal out of that, and he wants to see Florida's tourism continue to grow, and so he was very angry about that.
That's Derek Ham from the Palm Beach Post, also with us Paula Uspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review, Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. I'm Phil Latzman. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. As Derek just mentioned, busy day in Tallahassee. One of the things they're talking about, many worried about how legislators' reform of citizens' property insurance might adversely affect the economy, the real estate market in particular, especially for new buyers. The Florida Senate passed a sweeping overhaul of the state-run insurer of last resort yesterday. The vote 24-15. Senator David Simmons was the sponsor, says the adjustment is necessary.
That's the reason we're in this mess, simply because we have gone ahead and ignored what is actuarially sound and fiscally responsible. It's time now, members, to do the right thing.
And it's expected to drive over 200,000 citizens, 1.3 million policies into private hands. And, Dara, many are threatening political consequences if this does manage to pass the full legislature.
Yes. Senator Simmons actually was talking about the wind policies in the coastal regions of the state, and he called it welfare for the wealth. For the wealthy. That angered some of the coastal representatives or senators, and you know, he said that it wouldn't. There was a debate, an argument over whether or not it would raise rates. I think they did make some concessions to grandfather in people who are currently customers, so that I believe that it would cap the increase on their rates at 10% a year, but new customers would have to pay these actuarially sound rates, and that would mean that new customer rates in Palm Beach County, they would be about 60-85% higher than what they are now.
Wow, that's going to get a lot of people's attention, and that's going to get a lot of real estate agents' attention too, Paula.
Well, you know, some people are going to be kind of happy about this because most of these policies are, you know, coastal. These are properties on the water. So people who live east of I-95, you know, closer to the water, it's true. Right now, if there is a, you know, something bad happen, we all are going to have to pay for their repairs. Why do I, who live close to the Everglades, which is really west, have to pay for them? But if I lived east, you know, I would definitely be very upset, and I wouldn't vote for those legislators who, you know, voted for this policy.
But Steve, this is like the great divider, though, because the disconnect between North and South Florida, coastal residents, inland residents. I mean, this is two different Floridas here on this.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, Paula's right about one thing, is that the people who live east of US 1, I mean, are generally more affluent than people who live west. And so if you're going to look at the fairness of doing this, I mean, you know, perhaps it's not unfair. But on the other hand, the people who really get hit will be the people who buy and move in now and have to get insurance for the first time.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. The conversation is just beginning. We have one going on online. We're going to shift the focus to talk more about some of the other issues happening in Tallahassee, Dara, and also Gina Jordan, our reporter. They're going to talk about some education stuff a bit later on. Also with us again, Steve Rothaus from the Herald and Paula Uspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review. We'll take a break and continue our discussion in just a moment. Stay with us. And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. And Steve Rothaus, Paula Uspa Abbott, and Derek Ham, our guests, and your questions are welcome. You can email us. We have an email, the Florida Roundup at gmail.com. We're also taking some of the calls, trying to navigate the phone system, which is not always my favorite thing to do. So, there are some phone lines open, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We're also tweet-able at call sign WLRN, as long as we're in the tweet mode. Paula, yours is easy, actually. It's Pius Pa. You know, spell it out for your Twitter handle.
It's a P. I use P I U S P A.
I say Pius Pa. And Steve Rothaus. That's the
Steve Rothaus at Steve Rothaus.
Okay. And dare I know your DKPB post. So we'll get back. I think Dara, we lost on the phone line due to my nimble fingers. Hopefully we'll get her back on in just a moment. By the way, I'm at Phil Latzman. And we have a live blog going, as we mentioned, by our social media editor, Danny Rivera, who is the maestro of our online presentation. And that discussion is happening on our Facebook page and also at WLRN.org. So we'll continue some of the discussion here about the Medicaid situation. As soon as we get Dara back on, talk more about what's happening in Tallahassee. But this week, the House rejected a Senate proposal that would use billions of dollars in federal money to help low-income Floridians get health insurance. Representative Mike Fasano offered the Senate plan as an amendment that sparked hours of debate yesterday. He appealed to the House's more conservative members not to vote based on TV and radio talk show hosts.
Don't follow their script. Follow your heart today. Follow your heart and support this amendment.
But in the end, Fasano was the only Republican to vote for it, and his amendment failed on an otherwise straight party line vote. Matt Hudson of Naples didn't buy it.
Members, you can call it whatever you want. But this amendment is still Medicaid expansion.
State lawmakers are said to be hammering out a deal that would use a blend of state and federal money to offer health care coverage to uninsured Floridians under the federal health care mandate. So I believe Dara is back with us, although she didn't hear the presentation coming in there. Sorry to have cut you off, Ms. Cam, but the discussion...
No,
it was my fault.
What are we on?
We're on Medicaid now. We just heard Mike Fasano, the lone House Republican, to vote for his own amendment on how to incorporate Medicaid and expand health care in Florida to the more than 1 million people uninsured that are waiting to figure out what's going to happen with implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and so is everybody in Tallahassee, right?
It's a mess. The Medicaid situation is a mess. It looks every day it looks more doubtful that they're going to get to a resolution before the end of the session. Although, you know, you're familiar with this, Phil. You've watched this game before, so you know there might be on the last day there's somebody comes up with a deal, and they may have a plan that they've all agreed to already for all we know, but by all outward appearances there's no agreement. The Senate, I don't know what you all just said, I'm sorry I was not able to hear, but the Senate has a plan that would take some of the federal money and expand Medicaid. The House plan would not use any federal funds. It's about $237 million of state funds, much more limited coverage for poor, low-income individuals to purchase. This would give them a $2,000 subsidy to purchase health insurance.
But so they're really far apart, very far apart.
They're very, they're far apart philosophically. They're far apart financially. And the governor has not been pushing on this. He's been pushing for his two priorities, which are a manufacturing tax break, a tax break on manufacturing equipment, and a $2,500 across the board pay raise for teachers. He has not, you know, that's what he talked, no matter what the question is, that's the answer that the governor gives you these days. But he hasn't been pushing them or trying to encourage, at least as far as we can tell, some sort of an agreement on Medicaid. So it looks, And the speaker indicated yesterday, Speaker Will Weatherford indicated yesterday, if we don't get a plan, we don't get a plan, we'll take a breather, we'll come back. There's been a lot of talk about a special session on the Medicaid issue. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if we do have that.
All right, now on ethics, we had the wide-ranging ethics reform bill. The governor has this bill this week, and I know, Paula, you've done some looking into what that ethics bill entails.
If you look at the press release that they put out, the Senate put out this week, I mean, you would be happy and kind of proud. But then when you read at the language of the actual bill, there is a part that says, state officers may not vote on matters that benefit them directly. Not like you're prohibited
right.
from.
You go to jail.
Exactly. And if for some reason you have to vote, you have to make every effort to disclose your conflict of interest before the vote. But if you can't, you can disclose it after the vote. I love to have an editor that would say to me, you may not write a story that is going to benefit you directly, but if you have to write about what a great landlord you have and that how he's going to give you a discount next month, just you can disclose it before or after the article runs.
Go ahead, Dara.
One of the even bigger things that people, critics of the bill say is included in it is that they would be able to amend their financial disclosures. So if they leave something out of their financial disclosures, they would be able to change that even after a complaint has been made without any penalty.
So it also eliminates these committees of continuing existence that we've heard about. It raises some campaign finance limits. I guess at this point, the governor, this passed unanimously, right? Unanimously
right.
through both chambers. So the governor would have no choice but to sign this, right?
Well, we're talking about two different bills. One is the ethics bill and the other is the campaign finance bill.
Okay.
And these are two of the top priorities of the House and Senate, leaders of Speaker Weatherford and President Gates. And the big thing in the campaign finance reform is that it doubles the contribution limits, which are now $500, to $1,000 for legislative candidates and local candidates, and increases it to $3,000 per election cycle for statewide candidates, like for the governor or the cabinet members, like attorney general. That's a big deal. The governor has said he said even Wednesday, the day that they passed it, and held a joint press conference, boasting about their passage of these two measures, that he doesn't see a reason to increase the campaign contributions.
Right.
So signaling that he might veto that. So we've got kind of a little standoff here with them. He wants his two priorities, which have not been passed, which I mentioned earlier, and they sent this to him also early enough so that he has to act on it within 7 days if they pass it. If he receives a bill during the session, he has longer after the session ends, signaling, we could override your veto. They won't do that. It would be very unlikely for a Republican legislature to override a Republican governor's veto. Mm-hmm. But there's a little gamesmanship, in fact, maybe a lot of gamesmanship and muscle flexing that's going on
and
right now.
Speaking of gamesmanship, we actually have a game. It's called the ethics game this is serious. We've done this on our website at WLRN.org. You can see for yourself how the current ethics rules work. This is something that our producer, Elaine Chen, worked on very hard with the last Gameo at the Herald. You go to our website, you play. It's called Tala Nasty. And you see how ethical you can be as a Florida politician. It's at WLRN.org. It's very well done, and you will get a chuckle over it, I guarantee you. One other thing I wanted to mention that before we get into some other stuff in education, Gina Jordan, our reporter, also in Tallahassee, is going to join us in just a few to talk about that. But coming into the session, and I don't know, Paula and Steve, if you heard much about this, but I'm sure Dara did. People told the Public Insight Network that we work with very closely about the need for alimony reform in the state of Florida. And the outcry was just enormous, and we ended up doing some stories that came up at the town hall meeting that we had. Anyway, it's been all over the place. And now the alimony bill, which changes bans permanent alimony is on the desk of Governor Scott. It would make it harder to get alimony when a marriage lasts less than 11 years. It would set limits on payments based on the income and length of the marriage. Here's Representative Rich Workman, who is the House sponsor, who wants the governor to sign it quickly.
He's never indicated that he has a concern about it, so this isn't about a concern. This is about encouraging him to do it right away. Let's get this bill, this law on the books as soon as possible.
So he says he's reviewing the bill, and what do you think he'll do with this one now that it's passed the legislature?
Well, let me tell you, right now as we speak, there's about a couple of dozen women in Scott's office protesting, asking him to veto the bill. So he's getting a lot of pressure from both sides on this issue. I will tell you, and I don't know, you can maybe back me up on this, I have, of all the stories that I have written in the past 10 years, I have received more comments and more feedback on this than anything else. On both sides. This is just a very, very emotional issue. I don't know if you mentioned the retroactivity portion of this. It's got a lot of people concerned. So, you know, the governor hasn't given his... you know, tipped his hat either way about what he's going to do on this. You know, he's running for re-election. There's a concern that this, that he wants the women's vote, right? Mm-hmm. So how would that impact the women's vote? There's a lot of second wives, people who are married to folks who are paying lifetime alimony, who are coming out very strongly in favor of this reform. So I don't know. He hasn't telegraphed at all which way he's going to go on it. He does, I believe, have until Wednesday to act on that. Of course, if he doesn't veto it or sign it, it would become law without his signature.
All right. Well, you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for doing that. It's Dara Camp from the Palm Beach Post with us here in the studio. She's in Tallahassee with us here in Miami. Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. We're going to talk about more local stuff a bit later on in the show. And also with us is Paula Uspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review. We've talked about the economy in Florida. We did ask for some feedback from the listeners on the phones. And we do have Barry from Plantation who has been standing by. So we'll take you, Barry. Welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Well, thank you. I have a comment about headlines and looking beneath the surface. All these headlines about how the unemployment rate is dropping in South Florida looks good, but when you look beneath the surface, it continues to be the land of the $10 an hour job. Most of the jobs are created in hospitality or in restaurants. They're not jobs that will sustain a middle income standard of living. In fact, the jobs that do in government have been on the decline, and they've been replaced by hospitality and fast food jobs that pay $10 an hour. So my point is you have to look beneath the surface. Yeah, more jobs will be created, but what type of jobs and what do they pay? I'll take my answer off the list. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Barry. Thanks very much for your call. This is a familiar refrain, though, Paula. We've heard this before and still do hear it.
Yeah, we have. Totally. He's so right. And that brings us to the bill that it has to do with education and, you know, trying to train, you know, a younger generation and, of course, you know, not so young, you know, give them new skills because otherwise he's absolutely right. You know, we're all going to be fighting for jobs at McDonald's. Fighting, you know, because there are many applying for the same position.
Steve, has it always been this way where, you know, the economy is kind of, there's a few good jobs and the rest of them are...
Well, I think that in Florida, of course, we've always had service workers. We've always relied on the tourist industry to employ people. And these jobs are, you know, low-paying jobs that are often, you know, based on gratuities, people who depend on tips. And have very low salaries, if any. So I think that there's not anything really new about this here. But,
right.
I mean, of course, it's an ongoing issue.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Speaking of education, we've had a reporter in Tallahassee, Gina Jordan, standing by, and we're a bit delayed getting to her. But what we're going to do, we'll take a break here. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. When we come back, we'll get into an education discussion. We're going to have that with our Public Insight Network audience as well and talk about some more local and regional things. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment. And thank you, Paul Leary. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, and our guests here in the studio this week, Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. You can read his work at miamiherald.com/gay. He covers the LGBT community in South Florida. I've said that enough on the air. I should get it right. And a whole bunch of other things. A veteran South Florida journalist, Paula Uspa Abbott, is a staff writer with the Daily Business Review. And Derek Hamm is with the Palm Beach Post, covering Tallahassee and doing it so well, as she's joining us on the phone line from the state capitol. Also joining us from the state capitol for a discussion about some very important education news this week that may have flown a bit under the radar is our reporter, Gina Jordan. Welcome, Gina. Good to have you.
Hi, Phil. Thank you. One more week. One more week up here.
One more week. Thanks for your patience as well. And, you know, I think this was mentioned before by Dara, one of the governor's major initiatives, and across the board, $2,500 pay raise for teachers is in serious jeopardy right now. It's been taken off the board by the Florida legislature, but they've agreed at least on the amount of money to set aside for educators, just not exactly how to use it, right?
That's correct. And they both feel very differently about this. The governor wants, like you said, across the board raise for teachers. But the legislature says we want to give some money to all instructional personnel, not just teachers. And they want some of that money to be based on performance. So they're looking at teacher evaluations and merit pay. And plus, they've also said, House Speaker Will Weatherford said, the lawmakers cannot tell local districts how to dole out that money. That's a collective bargaining issue. So he says, we can come up with the money, but we cannot tell local districts they have to give every teacher $2,500.
And also this week, Governor Scott signed a major legislative overhaul, and more importantly, perhaps, of Florida's public schools. The new law rolls back high school graduation requirements in algebra and chemistry. It creates online-only bachelor degrees from the University of Florida, and it weakens the importance of the FCAT exam. And then the governor likes another requirement, allowing for more career-specific courses.
Every time I go to a school and I talk to students, what do they want? They want a job. And finally, with this bill, Florida's colleges will provide our students the opportunity to get a degree for $10,000 or less in tuition.
So now there are two different standards, if I'm getting this right, for getting a high school diploma. There's a standard diploma versus a scholar diploma, two-tiered system?
That is correct. And essentially, both of them will get students ready for college. That's the idea. But one focuses on those students who are absolutely sure they want to go to college, they want to go maybe to a competitive university. The other one is for those students who may not want to go to college. Maybe they're not sure what they want to do yet, but there are some things they enjoy doing, and maybe they can start taking classes in those things in high school. And maybe then those kids will be more apt to stay in high school and graduate. That's the idea.
But this is only about 3 years ago. You remember, and I remember as a parent of kids in public schools, that the emphasis was changed to this, and now they're going back, and it seems like pretty inconsistent. First, the emphasis was that they had to have these skills to graduate, and now 3 years later, they've changed their mind.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's because they are looking at it and saying, this is getting tougher, and we don't want lose kids. We don't want more kids dropping out because it's so difficult. Let's acknowledge that not everybody wants to go to college, and let's make it so that they can stay in high school, take some classes that they enjoy that will set them up for a decent career after high school.
And we asked members of the Public Insight Network this week about these changing requirements, and we got quite a bit of good feedback, so this way we decided to talk about some of these important things. And one of the people that responded was Todd from Miami Springs, who is on the line with us. Todd, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi there.
So how does it feel to know that these standards are changing?
Well, as I indicated in the response to, on the Insight Network, I sit on an apprentice committee where we review applicants for a plumber's apprenticeship school, and we look at the transcripts. I mean, we want to know that, as a matter of fact, it's a requirement that they have a diploma, whether it be standard or a GED. But one of the things we're looking at is their actual transcripts mm-hmm. to see what kind of courses they took. I don't understand why, other than to maybe show that the state of Florida is now going to have more kids graduating with diplomas, what else this does than set up a two-tiered system whereby one diploma is of less value than another.
Yeah, interesting. Go ahead, Steve.
That's exactly what I've been thinking, is that this seems that almost in terms of certifying students that they have qualified to do a job of some kind versus giving them a diploma for them to move on to the next stage of education. But, I mean, is this really very different than GED? And how will this two-tier system actually play out when people go to get jobs if they have either a high school diploma or a certification in some skill?
Hey, Todd, I think I cut you off. Again, my phone problems continue here, but thanks. Very, very well said. But I think we still have Gina on there talking about the requirements. And do you hear a lot of those stories, too?
Well, I think that that is the big question mark. And what the leaders who approve of this keep coming back to is, we want to keep kids in school. We have to acknowledge that a lot of these students don't want to go to college. And if we can offer them classes in high school, instead of saying you have to take Algebra 2 and Chemistry to get a diploma, we could say, all right, you get a diploma if you will go a different track and look at doing something involving technology or something where you could be certified to, say, be a pharmacy technician, that sort of thing. Then maybe those kids will stay in high school and maybe they will be more apt to fill some of the gaps that the state is having in certain industries where there are openings that can't seem to be filled.
Other members of the Public Insight Network who chimed in on this, Shawnee Scott from Miami, she's a teacher, she writes to us, not every student is college material, nor does every student really want to go to college. Why not allow students to follow a track that will take them to the place that best suits them? Marianne Balaban from Hollywood writes, I think it's a great idea. I went to high school in Ontario, Canada. We had diplomas where you went to college or university and vocational training. That way those who learned by doing had an opportunity to get an education and be employable as opposed to dropping out of school. And one other chime from the Public Insight Network, Gloria Zogby from Miami. She's a parent of a Miami-Dade public school student. She writes, they have magnet schools for trades, but everyone should get the same diploma. Students don't know what they want to study until they graduate or are in college. And Paula, just kind of putting the period on the sentence here, this really does kind of relate directly to the conversation we've been having about our economy.
You know, recently I had conversations with business people, of course, and one, his family owns a dealership, and he was telling me that his brother, the person I was talking to is a lawyer, and his brother, the family owns a car dealership, and he was saying his brother has a very hard time finding mechanics because nowadays a mechanic needs to know how to run computers. He said, you know, they're fighting. They're trying to steal mechanics away from other. So I think this is great. This is a step in the right direction. In the construction industry, you know, you have people who need to know how to run certain machines. You need welders, and those get decent pays. You know, 50,000, 60,000. I mean, so those exactly.
Plumbers too, by the way. That's a good profession that you don't need to.
It's a great profession.
You need to make decent money. So very interesting. Thanks for the calls and the feedback. Gina and also Dara are still with us from Tallahassee. We'll move into some other stuff, and we'll talk about Earth Day in Florida, and Monday marked Earth Day here in the low-lying, hurricane-prone peninsula. It's a day that has taken on some special meaning. Sea level rise is not something that we no longer just kind of ignore and don't notice. It's something we've seen. It's visible, and planning for a future dealing with it has become a top priority, as we've been reporting here for our local towns and cities and counties. Some say the predicament was foreseen by former Vice President Al Gore in his book, An Inconvenient Truth. Gore has a new book out called The Future, and he spoke with us recently about the impacts of sea level rise on South Florida.
In terms of the assets at risk, the value of assets at risk, South Florida and the New York, New Jersey area are number one and number two, not only on the U.S. list, but on the global list. There is a great deal of debate in the scientific community about how rapidly, but the range is in a meter to a meter and a half or slightly more by the end of this century.
I heard from a lot of people this week when we aired this interview, upset that we'd have Al Gore on for Earth Day. This, you know, is a hack. He's got political motives anyway. So I heard a lot of that this week. But, you know, Paula, this is something you've done a lot of reporting on at the Daily Business Review, what he says there, whether it's accurate or not. But are people prepared?
I have to tell you that we are on our way, especially in South Florida. In the last 9 months, I don't know what happened to people, but they're becoming very aware of this issue. You have Miami Beach commissioners going to Tallahassee, asking the state to please put the money that they had promised to renourish our beaches. You had people in Hellandel Beach having a workshop, you know, talking to the community, and that is what we need. We need the community to be informed so they can put pressure, you know, they can pressure elected officials to act. We don't have a lot of reaction from the state legislators, and for what I hear, you know, we get barely any feedback from you know, Washington D.C. And this is an issue that we can't just handle, pay for the adaptation, moving infrastructure away from the ocean ourselves. You know, you can't ask Miami Beach to pay for the cost of upgrading that infrastructure. This has to be paid. You know, it's too big for just a city.
Dara, if you're still with us there, and I know we're dueling phone lines here, but Dara, what's the discussion been like in Tallahassee over the anything at all?
Crickets.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, nobody's talking about it up here. You know, Governor Rick Christie, Chris Christie in New Jersey made a big deal after Sandy about saying this is proof that climate change exists. And, you know, the thought in Florida in the environmental community was, oh, good, this is going to urge Republicans even in this state to come forward and acknowledge that we have to deal with this, you know, with living in a peninsula. But no, nobody's talking about it. And you would think that now, you know, they've got a little extra money in the budget, they could throw a little money that way, but it's politically not something that a very conservative legislature is interested
in. I'm sure if you brought up the name Al Gore, you'd probably get a lot of sighs.
We don't mention him up here.
Speaking of things that are being mentioned in Tallahassee, here's the Dolphins Stadium issue. As the Dolphins and Miami-Dade tourism officials met with the NFL this week to present their initial bid to host Super Bowl 50 in 2016. At the meeting, NFL officials were said to be impressed with the plans, but not necessarily the stadium, you know, wink, wink. Local Super Bowl committee chair Rodney Barreto said NFL officials applauded Miami-Dade's presentation.
Most people will be quite surprised of the amount of thought and due diligence that we've done to put on something that the likes of that no one has ever seen in Miami.
However, upgrades to Sun Life Stadium did cast a shadow over the proceedings. Dolphins CEO Mike D called the issue the biggest stumbling block.
In my mind, it's the only impediment. The only way I see us not being successful is if we're, you know, having to compete on this uneven playing field.
So now we're waiting for the state Senate to consider a bill that would have $15 million in sales tax rebates for stadium renovations and a possible $3 million yearly subsidy for the Dolphins by ending, Paula, we're finding out this week, ending a tax deduction that's been reserved for international banking operations. And a lot of people on Brickell Avenue not happy about hearing that.
You know, for a long time, that industry brought a lot of money to our economy. So I wonder if, you know, they say that, you know, they don't need that tax break anymore because they're already here. But I wonder if that is true, boy. I don't know why, you know, why stop something that is not, why fix something that is not broken? You know what I mean?
Right, taking Peter.
I can tell you the Florida Senate just adjourned or is preparing to adjourn for the day right now, and they did not take up the stadium bill.
Right.
So whatever, that's been the hang up. They're waiting for the Senate, and there's no money in the House hasn't heard it in appropriations, and so we'll see what's going on right now.
Yeah, and of course that's contingent upon what happens with the vote May 14th in Miami-Dade County. I guess the idea is if that does not pass in Tallahassee, there will be no vote here in Miami-Dade County, as far as I understand it, for the referendum that would raise the hotel sales taxes in mainland Miami-Dade. So stay tuned on that, and you know we've got you covered. Now, Steve Rothaus, there's been a lot of talk about the Miami Beach Convention Center and sort of being ignored. I mean, here is your convention center in the middle of your most populated, most visited, most visible place, South Beach, and nobody's talking about revamping that, which certainly I think anybody that's been there knows it needs that. But there's also been an outcry about saving a famous theater, the Fillmore Miami Beach. But so first of all, talk about the convention center and plans that to try and revamp and revitalize it.
Well, the convention center area, which is, I guess, just north of Lincoln Road Mall, the convention center is an enormous property that really is not very functional. There's no hotel space around it. There are lots of reasons why the whole area needs to be made over. But we're talking about the theater, which is right in the heart of that neighborhood, which is the Fillmore today, known as the Jackie Gleason Theater for many years, and before that, the Miami Beach Theater for Performing Arts. And before that, it was the old boxing arena in Miami Beach, and basically was used for sporting events until the early 60s, when Jackie Gleason moved his TV variety show from New York to Miami Beach. And he performed and taped the show at the Beach Theater for about 4 or 5 years, and gave Miami Beach a tremendous amount of publicity. The show would open every week with a shot across Biscayne Bay, zooming into the Miami Beach, and you know, Gleason would come out and say Miami Beach audiences are the greatest audiences in the world, and people would cheer. And Hank Meyer, who was the famed publicist in that period of time, milked it for all he could get, and Gleason really became the face of Miami, and then beyond, because he actually lived in Inverary, and you know, he did his Inverary Golf Classic in Broward, and so he really had this empire that had stretched across Dade and Broward counties. Gleason's show went off the air in 1970, and for about 4 or 5 years, the theater was not used for very much, but in the mid to late 1970s, that's when Zev Buffman moved his operation from Coconut Grove, from the Coconut Grove Playhouse, to the Miami Beach Theater, and it was a municipal theater the city put a lot of money in, and, you know, brought in all of the big Broadway shows. This is long before there was an Adrian Arts Center, and the interesting thing is that the theater itself was absolutely awful. I mean, we would go to shows, we couldn't hear. You'd be sitting way in the back, you couldn't see.
But they redid it.
But all the shows came in. But I remember stars. I believe Alexis Smith was here doing The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. She stopped the show and apologized to the audience for the horrible sound. The city had to close the theater for, I think, 2 seasons and raise the roof. It still didn't make much difference, but essentially it was the only theater we had for Broadway in South Florida. I think a lot of people hold a lot of sentimental value to the theater, but whether it's historic or not, I mean, I was in there recently, and you know, it's a big barn. It is not the Adrian
sort
Arch
of like
Center.
Sort of like the Miami Herald building that we also work in.
My uncle was the drummer in Jackie Gleason's band on the Jackie Gleason show.
Wow,
he
what was his
the
name?
Drums in the band.
What was his name?
Hank Caruso.
Oh, wow. Very interesting little piece of trivia there, Dara Camp.
Yeah.
Hey, by the
How
way, before we say goodbye to you, you have some late-breaking, interesting news from Tallahassee that you wanted to tell us about, right?
Yes. All you people who like to rattle your windows and disturb your fellow drivers, you can rest happy, because the Senate killed a bill that would have reinstated a ban on the volume of car stereos.
Wow.
The Supreme Court struck that down on a tie vote this morning, actually. So Republicans joined in with Democrats to kill that. The Supreme Court struck it down in December, saying it was unconstitutional. They fixed it to make it constitutional. But you guys know, I'll try to find a Miami Republican...
We don't have time.
Said it'll keep you from it. It's a crime prevention measure, because you want to kill the people who are playing the music loud next to you.
Well, pump up your music, your WLRN, and your cars right now to celebrate that one. Dara Camp, and for that matter, Gina Jordan, who's been standing by with us with the news from Tallahassee. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, guys.
All right, and Paula Uspa Abbott from the Daily Business Review. Let me make sure that we don't hear them hanging up. There we go. I hate the phone system. Anyway, Paula, thanks for being with us from the Daily Business Review.
Happy to be here.
Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. It's always good to have you.
Thank you, Phil.
And that does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, April 26, 2013. If you missed any, we do post it on our website, WLRN.org, rebroadcast at Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. The Florida Roundup is produced ably by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman, our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, our social media editor, Danny Rivera, our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it is Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. Great job, as always, Paul. South Florida Arts Beat is next, and it's only a game if it's on Saturday. I'm Phil Latzman. Till next week, stay informed, South Florida.